Okay, I think it's a good time to start now. So welcome to this January retreat. We do a retreat here, I teach a retreat about this time every year. So welcome everybody. But first of all, how many of you have been on one of my retreats before? Very good. How many haven't been on one of my retreats before? And how many can't understand what I'm saying? There's about half-half, anyway. Okay, so on these meditation retreats which I conduct, having conducted these retreats for so many years, there's many things which we learn as teachers and also as students. And one of those things which you learn is that you have to work with your body and also with your mind. So to try and control the body or try and control the mind just makes you far too tense. But if you slack off too much, then you spend all the time sleeping. There is such a thing called the middle way. And in order to find that middle way, we have to have some mindfulness, some awareness. It's difficult at first, because when we start a retreat, you'll notice this by the end of the retreat, the mindfulness which you bring in on a retreat is usually quite weak and tired, low energy, low power, simply because of the busyness of our lives. Because we work hard, we have many duties to do, many sort of problems to fix up, that means that you are naturally tired. So, if you fight that mind, you will find that you just get even more tense simply because it's the wrong path. Many of you may know some of the stories of the Buddha's own search for truth and enlightenment, and that he tried really, really hard practices for so many years. And in the end, he just gave up on that struggle and striving, and instead learned how to meditate peacefully. And his first teaching, which he gave after his enlightenment, was called the middle way, to avoid the extremes. And one of those extremes, Atta Gilamata Anuyoga, literally means things which tire you, which exhaust you. And he said, that's not our path. So instead, for the first few days, especially of these retreats which I teach, it is nice and comfortable, and it's easy. There is a schedule, but you are quite free to adjust that schedule as you need. I often say that, what time, even I don't know the schedule, that's how important it is. What time are you supposed to get up in the morning? You don't know either. 4 o'clock, is it? Okay, but it's optional. What does optional mean? You can always get up earlier. Or later. In other words, especially for the first few days, you try and keep it natural. Find as much rest as you need. You find your middle way, what you need to actually to rest and relax. And you should be able to find that pretty easily. If you sleep too much, you get very, very dull. Sleep too little, you get tense. What is very nice is that we don't have any bells to wake you up in the morning. I thought that was really awful when on some retreats one person is assigned to actually to have a bell and to ring going past every room, every hut, and they are the most unpopular person in the whole retreat, the bell ringer. And not only that, that it was my experience for many times going to these retreats, or even going to practice, to train under an Ajahn Chah. There were some times, just when your meditation was getting very steep, and what happened? Gong. And I often reflected what would have happened if the Buddha was sitting under the Bodhi tree and somebody suddenly went gong and it would never got enlightened. Meditation is a natural process. Enlightenment is a natural process. And finding truth is a natural process. And if we try to put a time schedule on it, it just makes things much, much worse. It makes it tense. That's what you have to do in the world. You have to get up at a certain time to go to work. You have to go at a certain time to actually to catch your bus or catch your flight. And what a wonderful thing it is here. The only times you really need to worry about is your breakfast and lunch. And you will find you don't need a clock or a bell to tell you when breakfast is or lunch is. Everybody just knows when that time is. You can smell it, your tummy starts to rumble, and there it is, it's lunchtime or it's a breakfast time. But when we don't have these schedules, it does mean that your meditation becomes far more natural. If the meditation is really going deep, you can just carry on. If the meditation is really just a bit hard, you're tired, or you're hurting, then you can go and do some walking meditation, or you can just go and have a rest. And many, many times when I started teaching like this and encouraging people, there will be a lot of resistance. Some people said, no, I can't go and have a rest. I rested before. I said, go and have a rest. And they said, no, it's just being lazy. Go and take a rest. And I had to sometimes argue with them to say, go and take a rest and have a rest. Don't put your clock on to actually to know how long, and just rest. And then when you wake up, have a shower, have a cup of tea. And they always have some of the best meditations after that practice. Why? It's because they're not forcing their mind. They're relaxing it. They are letting go. And many, many times I've done this teaching. And Kanchana, you have got that seat, so you have to be my assistant. Meditation, many of you have seen this before. Meditation is not about concentration, it's about stillness. Allowing things to be still. Concentration, focusing, holding something will cause you headaches and tiredness. It's too tight. So in order for this to be still, come closer so you can actually see. But first of all, are you an honest meditator?
I hope so.
Very good. That's why I always say this in this demonstration. That's why at Venerable Posada I didn't get you to do this demonstration, because that would be a bit sort of insulting. Insulting. Are you honest? So, now my goal is to keep this water totally still. So has it stopped moving yet?
Nope.
Why is that? Because I'm paying no attention. I'm not being mindful. So now I'm being mindful. Has it stopped moving yet? Because I'm not putting any effort in. I'm not concentrating. So I'm trying to concentrate. Something's disturbing me. So has it stopped moving yet?
No, I don't.
And of course, those of you who've seen this before, I can do this for hours, trying to keep a water in a cup or a vessel still by being aware and concentrating. You don't get anywhere, you just get tired. But fortunately, that there's a very simple way of keeping water in a cup or a glass perfectly still for hours and hours and hours. And it's exactly how the Buddha taught, to let go. Let go of grasping. Put things down. So I now put down my cup of water. So easy. Is it stopped moving yet? Be honest.
Yeah.
Now it has, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Honest Kanchana. Okay, come on then. You should do this. Now, the purpose of that simile is to demonstrate what the path of meditation is. Letting go. Not controlling, not forcing your body, but actually learning how to let go, to be aware, but with no effort. Effort is trying to get something in the future. Put struggle, that's what we have to do sometimes. That's, you know, the meaning of much of our life. To get this place built took a lot of effort. To actually organize a retreat, a lot of effort. For you to get here was a lot of effort. But now you're here. How about stopping and just being here? And letting the mind become still, just as put down the cup. But be very careful. Because sometimes people say, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. You know what they do? They put the cup down. Is it still yet or not yet? Still yet? Come on. When are you becoming still? Come on. I haven't got all. I've got 9 days. I've paid a lot of money for this and, you know, had to sort of struggle to get here. You're not still yet? Come on. When are you going to be still? So you also you need some patience and don't interfere with the process. Very often that people, they just want quick results. And straight away there's something terribly wrong with that idea. Wanting results. It's what we call spiritual materialism. Just like we want results, you know, from our studies, we want some degrees, or we want sort of pay packets from our work, we want appreciation from all the hard work we do, instead of just doing it for no results, for the sake of just doing it, just being, and especially learning how to be still, letting go. So little by little, to be able to let go, to understand what that letting go means, we start with our meditation, just getting to know our body. And if you think you know your body, that's an assumption which you should really challenge by investigating your body. And by investigating, I don't mean just getting a medical journal or book and just understanding what is this part, what is that part. Go beyond all the theory and go to the direct experience. How does your body work? Your body, not other people's bodies, your body. How does it feel? Number one, when you're meditating, how does your body feel right now? Is this the most comfortable posture for you? Or should you be sitting on a chair? Or getting a wall seat, which is one of the most popular positions. Much of the best seats are already taken by the wall. Where can your body feel comfortable? You don't have to meditate cross-legged in full lotus on the hard floor. That's why we have cushions for the softies. Real meditators, we just meditate on the hard stone. That's really crazy stuff, isn't it? People always have this idea, be tough. And unfortunately, I've met too many tough meditators, and they crack. They don't last the course, because it's going in a wrong direction. So we find how your body feels, and we work with our bodies. Your body does not need to be a perfect athlete. It doesn't need even to be healthy. It can even be sick, and sometimes one of the reasons I kept in mind when we built this place, that you all know that I was the main architect of this place, just arguing with the real architect, no, don't do it this way, I want it that way, and making sure things like every room has its own ensuite. You have walking meditation halls, you have an air con here, you have just comfort. And the reason why I did that, one of the reasons, is so that people who are sick, who aren't that fit, can actually come and enjoy some meditation. Because why is it that some of the people, the elderly, the sick, the infirm, the people who would benefit from meditation the most, are sometimes afraid to go to meditation retreats? It's just too tough for them. Or they have to sit in a specific position which is uncomfortable for them, really painful for them. And there's something which is terribly wrong about that. And the times when I was sick in my youth, especially as a young monk in Thailand, that the first year, it's an old story, but it fits in here well, when I developed a very heavy fever, we thought at the time it was typhoid. Well, actually, people didn't know what it was, because it had very high fevers. It was actually scrub typhus. But the authorities there thought that scrub typhus did not exist in that part of Thailand, only because the locals had immunity. It was only the visitors, you know, the Westerners, and of course, now, we were some of the very first white men who'd been in that area. And I still remember to this day going into one village and just going on arms round in that village. And people there, it was the first white man they'd ever seen, let alone a white monk, a Prapharang. And you know that those of you who've seen the arms round, you're supposed to put the rice into the bowl, and it's quite a big bowl, it's almost impossible to miss, but and you're not supposed to look gaze at the monks, but the people couldn't, and the food fell outside of my bowl, because, you know, they were just so surprised to see sort of a Westerner in robes. And the dogs were very happy, because the dogs loved me, because they got all the rice which fell on the floor. But I was saying that because, you know, that was one of the reasons why they didn't realize what the problem was. And so you're very sick for many weeks. So they'd known what it was, which they eventually found out, it wouldn't have lasted that long. But, you know, if you've had a fever for about 3 or 4 weeks, you feel really exhausted. It's a very strong fever, typhus, typhoid. And so, very strong fever. And I remember one occasion that Ajahn Chah, my great teacher, was of no real help. You know that story, you know, when he came in. And he said, Brahma Wang, so you'll either get better or you'll die. It's great now when I can tell other people that story, but I didn't appreciate it at all at the time. I wanted something better than that. But anyway, I remember just one afternoon, just, you know, laying in the bed, with, you know, your arms and hands all over the place, and your legs sticking one this way, one that way, you know, deciding, you know, just come on, you know, you shouldn't sort of just indulge in the fever and the complaining and the negativity. Let's do some meditation. And of course, when your body is very weak, in a fever, that you can't control the body at all. All you can do is make peace with your body. Be kind and be gentle with it. Just be with it instead of fighting it. And that was a wonderful experience. I don't say that, you know, you should get scrub typhus before you meditate, but it was an experience where, because, you know, that you had no choice at all, You just lay down there, meditated, and the body just disappeared again. And just got into a wonderful, deep, beautiful meditation. And of course, it was especially delightful because what it was contrasted with was a very sick, aching, energy-less body. But what was important for me at that time was to say, you don't need to be in any particular posture to get into the deep stillnesses of meditation. You don't even need to be in tip-top health to do this. You can be just so weak, within a fever, aching, no energy, and you can still let go. That's one of the reasons why, that when people who are really, really sick and ill, and I just go and see them, and they say, oh, I can't meditate. I say, what do you mean, you can't meditate? If you think meditation means sitting up straight for half an hour or an hour, yeah, of course not everyone can do that. Or crossing your legs in full lotus. Some people have motorbike accidents, they've had sports accidents. Of course you can, and that's not necessary. If you can, fine, it's a very great posture. But what happens if you can't do that? And they said, well, you don't even need to sort of, basically you don't need anything. You don't have to watch the breath at the tip of your nose. Just learn how to make peace and be kind, be gentle, be in this moment. Learn how to let go, to put a cup down. You could put anything in this cup. It could be a cup of tea. It could be orange juice. It could be water. It could be even poison. All you need to do is let it go. Put it down. Relax and rest. Can you do that? Do you have to be really fit and strong and have to be sitting in full lotus to be able to, 3 or 4 hours, to be able to put something down? So that's one of the reasons why you try to encourage everybody, whoever they are, no matter if they haven't, done any meditation before, or if they have been really sick, they're old, whatever, that learn how to put things down. Anyone can do that. So that's what we're going to be teaching for the next 9 days. How to let go. How to relax. And of course, that's what I kept on hearing from my teacher, Ajahn Chah. Some of the things which he taught me, the simile of the stick, similar to the cup simile, but less more dangerous, Ajahn Chah's similes. He would pick up a stick and he would say, how heavy is my stick? And before I could answer, he'd throw it away, excuse me. I usually throw it much further, but he said, it's only heavy when you hold it. When you throw it away, you let it go, it's no weight at all. Or his other simile, the leaf on a tree or on a bush, it only moves, why? Because of the wind. If the wind stopped, it will still move, but less and less and less and less, until it became perfectly still. Not because somebody held it still, only the thing, the cause of it moving, has been removed, stopped. So the leaf moves less and less because he called it its natural state. Well, we'd say these days its default state. The leaf is still, that's its natural state, its default state. It only moves, becomes something outside of it, makes it move. Wind. And then, of course, he made the connection between the human mind. The human mind is like that leaf. Its default state, its natural state, is to be still, not to move. It only moves because something outside of it is making it move. And that is the wind of wanting something. That is what agitates your mind, wanting. So if you let go of wanting and just be here, happy little meditator, just sitting here, nothing to do in the whole world. Oh, isn't that amazing? You don't have to achieve anything. We're not going to give certificates. I'm not going to grade you. I'm not going to expel you. Even though sometimes I say, well, we should, no, no. You don't judge anybody. So don't judge yourself. Just sit here and just learn what it's like just to be here instead of trying to go somewhere and get something. That's called wanting. So it's the wanting which makes you move. It's the not wanting which brings you to stillness. And where do you want to get to anyway? Where are you going? When you get there, is it going to be any different? Have you ever found that the problem is not destinations? The problem is just never being content where you are. You always think the next experience will be the happy one. And what was, some of you may remember my predecessor many years ago. I was supposed to be going to see him next June. Good old Ajahn Chakravo. One of his favorite stories was from Nasruddin. He was a Sufi mystic and a very funny guy. And he was sitting, eating a whole bunch of chili peppers. And he'd already, must have eaten already about 20 or 30 or 40 chili peppers. And you know what happens if you eat too many chili peppers? Just, you know, your eyes are sort of watering, your face is just all red, and there's like nasty stuff coming out of your nose. And he's about to put another chili pepper in there, and his friend said, what's going on? Why are you torturing yourself like this, eating so many chili peppers? And Nasruddin replied, I am looking for the sweet one. Chili peppers aren't sweet, they all burn. So that's why we always want to go somewhere. We always want the sweet one. Instead of just giving up the chili peppers, the wanting, and just being here. And finding out what it's like just to be instead of going somewhere. Which is one of the reasons why many of my stupidities, mistakes. There's this one fellow, he's still around, he teaches some meditation every month. He used to be a monk with us, that's a good old Jacob Medin. And I was just being busy as I usually am. And he just, because he's retired, I don't know how he got away with that to be able to retire. I'm still working hard. But anyway. Anyway, he was saying, Ajahn Brahm, how are you? And you know the silly thing I said? I said, well, I'm getting there. And that's when he really sort of caught me out. He said, Ajahn Brahm, exactly where are you getting to? I said, uh-oh. There's only two places I'm getting to. It's either in the crematorium or underground in my grave. That's the only place we get to. So from that time on, when people ask me, how are you? One of my answers was, I'm just being here. I'm not getting anywhere. Honestly, those of you who have been listening to me for a long time now, have my stories or jokes improved? I'm not getting anywhere. It's just all the same, just being here. But we always have this thing, we have to get better all the time. And no, just be here. So that will mean you can find some peace. All the secrets and the stillness and the amazing stuff of life is not to be found over there in the next moment, in the next meditation retreat, or in the next experience. It's always found right here, where you are, in this very moment, by going deeper in to where you already are. to do that, we need stillness. As much stillness as we can get. And stillness doesn't come from craving or wanting. Stillness comes from letting go of all of that and just being here. Putting things down, letting go, and being kind to your body. This is where we learn the power of letting go. Just when tomorrow morning, usually do a little guided meditation, a little body scan, just to get things started. And when you do a body scan, you don't just do it, you know, fast or slow. You get to a certain area of the body and you feel, oh, this is interesting. What's going on down here? You feel it. And once you start to feeling those parts of your body, you can actually learn how to understand them. Get to know them. Not what doctors say or experts. How you feel. You know, your intestines or your heart or your liver or you know, any other part of your body, you know, which is, how are we going to be having the cancer, oh, and I'm going over to their place, Cancer Wellness Association. Oh, they just keep changing the name. Solaris, I think they're called now. They go over there every year to teach people just how to understand their body. Once you get to know your body, it has a tumour somewhere, you get to know, you feel it, and you can actually manipulate it, work with it. What makes that feeling, and only you know how it feels, what makes it less intense? What makes it more intense? You get to know it, and once you get to know something, you do have some power over it. You get to feel, you get... Mindfulness gives you this incredible feedback. You know exactly what makes it worse, what makes it more easy to be with. Okay, so, okay, one of those stories. I have to make them personal. So the only reason I do them personally, because I know these things and I was there when it happened. When you start to describe other people, is that really what they said? So anyway, the personal story, in my cave over the road, in monastery, having a very, very bad food poisoning. In my hut, screaming. Ah! Oh! Ah! I like to be dramatic when I give talks because that was one of the things. I used to go to these talks with all these great monks and experts over in Cambridge. And, you know, because I went there because I thought I had to. As a Buddhist, I suppose I should go to the talks. And that was boring as hell. And I was going... I was telling that story with my mate, old Bernard. He was one of Stephen Hawking's good old friends. And I was telling his story once, and he sort of piped up. He said, yeah, because, you know, he was sometimes the MC at some of these talks. I was only just round at the back. And he said he was very embarrassed once when he was emceeing, you know, one of the talks by some famous Buddhist or whatever, and he fell asleep, fast asleep. Because, you know, sometimes the Buddhist talks are really boring. So, ah! That wakes everybody. Ah! So, whenever that happened, I was in my cave. No one could hear me. Because, you know, that's why I got the cave for. So I have a bit of solitude and privacy and stuff. Anyway, but, you know, it has its back, its negatives. So, you know, sometimes, and people think, what happens at Ajahn Brahm if you die in that cave? Great, it's a tomb already. You don't need to sort of find a nice, you know, tomb to put me in, a sarcophagus. Well, it's not called a sarcophagus, it's called a vault. Just keep me in there. But anyway, so... But I thought, hey, you know, you could open the door and call out, but you know what happens over here? It's still half an hour away from, you know, by the time you get somebody to answer the phone, and just, you know, I'm not quite sure if it happens, but if you ring the sort of the ambulance, your call is important to us. I don't know what happens. But anyway, I'll forget about that. So anyway, So instead you've got the, you know, your other level of understanding how to work with your body. And so what you do, you just be mindful of it. I mean, really get to know it. I know my body pretty well. You know, I've been living with it for almost, 67, 68 years. And part of your training is to really understand how this body works. Awareness of it. So you know, I know this feeling. And know how to, all I can say is how to relax it. So the next time there was this terrible cramps in your intestine, instead of ah, it was ah, slightly less intense. The next time, ah. But much slower than that. Little by little, you relaxed it. And you got feedback. Feedback was so easy because, you know, the pain, you know, which made you sort of cramp up, and this was automatic response is just, you know, to cry, scream, whatever it was called. And it got less and less and less and less and less and less. But now if I was afraid, tensed up, tried to get rid of it, it would get worse. So I just sort of had to relax and relax and relax and relax and relax and relax. And I think, I forget it was 20 minutes or 40 minutes, but it was incredibly fast. And it totally went. No pain at all, no cramps, and perfectly healthy afterwards. It's amazing just what you can do with your own body. And so any other time, if there's a bit of something going on in there, you locate it, get to know it, be kind to it, and relax it. And it goes away. Get colds. One of the nicest experiences I had was, because, you know, you learn these things from being a forest monk, because there's no medicine around there. So this was a case when there was, I was in Canberra, the first time I went to Canberra to give some talks. I wasn't really well known then, so no one really looked after me the way they pamper me these days. And so I never realised how cold Canberra is. You know, when you're sort of a westerner, you think every part of Australia is hot. And you go there, you see some snow in the winter time, really chilly. So the first night, you know, just, you know, obviously not really looking after my body, didn't know how cold it would be, started getting a cold. And so I had to have all these appointments, and people were very kind. They wanted to show me this and show me that. All I want to do is to go to bed. No, we want to sort of show you this and show you that. And then you went to see some monastery and just it took forever. And by the time they finished taking me around, I was supposed to give a talk that evening. And by the time I got to the temple, I had about 10 or 15 minutes before my talk was supposed to begin. And I tried to get a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, you know, just some strong tea to get an energy boost, something. All they had was this very weak Chinese tea. And, oh, crikey, I'm in big trouble now. And so, but anyway, people came to listen to the talk, and it was one of those really terrible talks. How can you give a talk when you've got snot running down your nose and every coughing and have to wipe your nose and say, oh, no, the Buddha talk, and the third, and then he thought, and we should not try. And you could see that you're losing all of the people's attention. They didn't have mobile phones in those days. Otherwise, they'd be texting somebody, you know, please pick me up straight away. This is boring. Get my taxi now. But they were looking at their clocks and their head were going down. So realize you were losing everybody. After 15 minutes, hopeless, I just said, okay, we're going to do some meditation at the end. Let's do it now. Half an hour meditation. So, you know, when I'm my own resources, you know what to do. Just feel that sort of, you know, the tension, the irritation, the headaches, the yuckiness, and just get to know that. Be kind to it. Let it be. You hear this story again later on, the monster in the emperor's palace. Welcome, monster. Welcome, just terrible, itchy, yucky, cold flu feeling in my head and nose. And then little by little, you could feel it getting less. That's what awareness is supposed to do, give you feedback. So you know if it's getting more comfortable, if it's getting more intense. And little by little, half an hour was enough to actually just, the fluid from my nose stopped. Headache, cough, disappeared. And I felt wonderful. So then I gave a talk. I remember the people said, what do you think of that talk? He said, well, actually, we weren't so much listening to the content of the talk, but just the fact you could give a talk. And he said, that was really amazing. That, you know, they saw you half an hour before, and you're just really sick. And now there was no sign of that sickness left. You can give a nice, fluent talk. And this is how we, this is why I encourage this, because it gives you some motivation. To get enlightened or to get peaceful, to get rid of depression, that's one thing. But your bodily health and well-being, that's something which is closer to you and higher up the level, the priority scale for you. And so when you start to learn how to deal with your body and your health through your mindfulness and wisdom and kindness, then afterwards use the same method to understand how your mind works. Do you know how your mind feels? Now, what you're supposed to watch to get to understand your mind. That is why, and I'll bring it up in the formal meditations later on, get to know your peaceometer. Oh, just by the way, this hall here, is it really too hot for you or is it too cold? Put your hand up if it's too hot for you. Can you put your hand up if it's too cold? Doesn't really matter. That's not why I asked the question. You are aware, mindful of the temperature, or rather your perception of that temperature. Now, how peaceful are you, or how agitated are you? You can know, if you look at the right thing, your level of peace or your level of agitation or irritation. You're getting to know important parts of the mind. Heat and cold, that's body stuff. Peace or agitation, it's opposite. That is something we can know from the mind. If you're too hot, how can you become cooler? You can take a jacket off or something. Please don't take too much off, otherwise you'll get thrown out of here. If you're too cold, you can put a blanket on or something. So you know how to adjust temperatures. Do you know how to adjust the amount of peace or the amount of agitation in your mind? That is really important to learn. How to have peace of mind instead of agitation of the mind. So little by little, we become aware of what I call the peaceometer. And that peaceometer, once you get to understand and look at that, and really understand how it works, how to make the mind more peaceful, how to make the mind more agitated, understand both, and understand that all this struggle and striving often just makes your mind even more tight, tense, agitated. Never has any peace. Open the door of your heart to this moment. Being kind to this moment. Letting this moment be. Appreciating this moment. Not finding fault with this moment. Patience. In other words, just letting this moment be. It will sort itself out. But not interfering. Leaving things alone, not grasping, putting things down, not worrying about judging whether you're going well or you're not going so well, not measuring stuff, but just being. And little by little, you find you get more and more peaceful. I know that the last retreat I gave, I think, was over in Malaysia. First question, I said, Bhajabram, you just said you should not measure, but then you talked about measuring the peaceometer. That's what we call the fault-finding mind. Always looking for, got you. But it's just looking at things from a different angle. You get to understand what peace is. And even trying to change things instead of trying to be with things is actually just makes it worse. And I saw this, good old Ajahn Bhumari got a lovely article from The Guardian. It was about sort of euthanasia in Holland. And just, you know, a little angle I'd never seen before about sort of euthanasia and suicide. And how sort of suicide really causes so much problems for the whole family. And they had this other word which I thought was really fascinating, consensual euthanasia. When the whole family and the doctors all agree it's the right time. Instead of one person doing something and upsetting just everybody. Because if you've ever known a suicide in your family or close to your family, or you know, people you have to counsel, it's devastating. But if you've ever known someone who has had, you know, consensual euthanasia, it's sometimes a very beautiful experience. That was interesting little. But anyway, one of the people who was a doctor who was writing about this was said, because as a doctor, her job is not to preserve life, as much as to care. And of course, that reminded me of that little insight, which is heaps powerful. The job of a doctor, what's the job of a doctor to do? To care. Much more important than to cure people. Care for people. That's your priority. If you want to cure at all costs, that's why I have these terrible interventions sometimes, especially end-of-life interventions. You know, why are they doing this? Because they're so afraid of getting sued or somebody dying or something. So they sacrifice care and kindness for preserving life so they don't get blamed. So anyway, just here, just caring for your body, caring for your mind is actually how we make it peaceful. Trying to cure your sicknesses, your depression. There's somebody, you know, remember at Armadale group? Somebody was really depressed, and I said, well, look at depression on another way. In depression, he said, you can sleep in the mornings, people really look after you, you can care, you can get special foods, and he was actually getting all the ice cream he wanted. I said, if you do start to feel better, don't tell anybody. Otherwise, you'll have to give up the ice cream. Making people look at it a different way. Caring for things, not trying to get rid of them. Getting rid of things, curing, it's negativity, it's anger, it's ill will. You're angry. Why me? Why do I have to deal with this? And so if you're caring for it, everything in your life you can learn from. If you care for it, it actually feels much easier. And it heals itself. So many people get sick and they die because they try too hard to cure themselves and get rid of the diseases. To lessen the fevers. Fevers, you know, as long as they don't get too high, that's the way that your body fights its viruses and bacteria. It's the body's way of doing it. So when people try and suppress it, they're actually not really helping their body much. So anyway, little by little, we learn how to care. Care for things in your mind. And you find that the mind becomes more peaceful. Caring is one of the greatest ways of having a peaceful mind, and cures just come by themselves. More cures than you'd expect. So you care for your mind. Find the peaceometer. If you care for something, it gets more and more peaceful. You try and cure it, and then it gets even worse. Try for caring. But that's actually my experience. You find out for yourself, experiment. What makes your mind more peaceful, more agitated? And little by little, you'll find some of the great truths which are right there, which the Buddha taught. And sometimes we don't see them because we think that can't be right. But it is right. Find out for yourself. So little by little, care for your body, care for your mind. And when you let go, I care for that cup, I care for my hand, that's really still. When your mind is still, really still, it doesn't go to sleep, it doesn't become stagnant. That's why the Ajahn Chah's biography, what's it called, like still water flowing or something. We always think that it's when it's very still that nothing happens. But it's when things are still, they really start to develop. Little things like when you go up to a... I thought this was my simile, but then I heard this Jogje meditation master last October, you know, he was talking and the same simile. I thought, wow. And you know, this is a universal simile in Buddhism, about going up into the mountains and seeing a lake, a pond of water. And only when that lake is perfectly still, when there's no ripples on its surface, can you see a perfect, true reflection of the moon and the stars in the heavens above. Only when it's perfectly still. Only when your mind is perfectly still can you see a true reflection of the nature of the life. Only through stillness can you see things as they truly are. And just to impress you that I don't make this up, Samadhi Pachayang Yathabhuti Yana Dasana. Pali. Don't need to quote it because it said it many times in the suttas. From stillness, samadhi, you see things as they truly are, yathabhuta, as they truly are, jnana-dasana, insight. So, this is what we're doing here. Stillness, wisdom, understanding, mindfulness, learning how to let go, how to relax the body, relax the mind. And then we find our mind becomes so still, you start to understand things much more than you've ever seen before. It also happens to be incredibly good fun. Lots of happiness and energy. Whoa, yes. So that is just a taster of what is to come next, the trailer of what we're going to be talking about the next 8 days. So hopefully that you all get the understanding of what we do here. Because you can come into this room, you can go out of this room whenever you wish. Because people will be going into the cottages, you know, at all sorts of odd times. I would ask you to be kind to the people who you share this centre with. By which, the noble silence... No, please don't talk to one another and just have conversations on the nature of reality. You know, just learn how to listen more than to talk. So if you do see somebody talking and they want to talk to you, look, if you start saying, no, I'm on noble silence, then you also disturb the peace. So here, what do we do when we want to remind a person that this is a quiet place? We give them the one finger sign. And what's the one finger sign? That's right, not that one, this one. So you can always say, so you don't need to talk. But against that also, sometimes people complain, oh, this is such a sort of unfriendly retreat. I can't talk to anybody. So you don't need to talk, but it's amazing what a little smile can do to the people who you share this retreat centre with, especially in your cottage. You can smile at them in the morning. And smile at people who you pass, you know, walking to and from wherever you're going. And also smile at the people when they serve you the food and when you eat. But try and do it silently, peacefully. And I know people, like every time, every retreat, they always say, look, why do people keep banging the doors? And why do they have to make a cup of tea or coffee at 2 o'clock in the morning? And they don't just make the cup of tea, they have to stir it up. And they wake everybody up. So can't you open and close the door quietly? Can you do that? Burglars can do that. James Bond can do that. That's why, did you ever notice why that he, I don't, maybe people my age, one of his catchphrases was shaken, not stirred, when he had his martinis. You know why it was shaken, not stirred? Because he learned that when you stir things, you make more noise. When you shake them, does it make much noise? So if you make yourself a cup of coffee in the morning, don't stir it. Shake it. What do you reckon? I'm making that up as I go along. But anyway, at least, you know, you can learn how to be quiet. So, especially, you know someone's already resting, they're sleeping there, just be quiet. Open the doors quietly, close them quietly. If you need some hot water, just, you know, boil the kettle at the right time. These are supposed to be, I think the previous caretakers, they got these kettles which are supposed to be really low noise kettles, as long as you don't leave water in them overnight. This one we've got is like that anyway. So you can boil it and it doesn't take much time and it's quiet. But you know, when you're just stirring in whatever you stir into your coffee or whatever, please do it quietly. And just go in and out quietly. If you take a shower, please don't sing in the shower. Just do it quietly. And you find that way, increasing your awareness, your mindfulness, and the noble silence is not forced on anybody. It becomes natural and beautiful and peaceful. And it also is the case that whenever you are, whatever you're doing, that you are looking after one another, kind to one another. But if sometimes it does happen, somebody bangs the door, they drop something, and if they do bang the door, well, it's nature. People make noises. So even we've got crows, we've got beautiful red-tailed cockatoos here, you've got lots of animals which make noise. Are you going to get angry at the magpies for not keeping noble silence? Of course not, because that's nature. So the same as people, they may bang the door once or twice. But if they do bang the door, please remember, the sound of the banging that lady just open and close the door without making any noise. Isn't that wonderful? Now, when you, if someone does bang the door, often the door banging has finished a long time ago, but it's still banging in your head. Why did you do that? We're going to find out who that was and tell her. If Ajahn Brahm doesn't tell her, like Venal Posada, my attendant, to tell. If he says, I'm going to tell Bianca, I'm going to tell somebody to ban her from these retreats. She shouldn't come to this retreat. I don't know why she's listened to this talk so many times and she still bangs the door. She's really just so hopeless. She's so insensitive. Where did most of the noise come from? From your head, by complaining about it, by holding on to it far too long. So in this retreat, someone bangs the door, bang, and it never echoes in your mind. The bang is finished, and it doesn't get exaggerated and prolonged by complaining. If you can do that, you learn so much about Ajahn Chah's great saying, it's not the noise disturbs us, we disturb the noise. Okay, so bang away and see what happens. Okay, so it's 9 o'clock now, it's actually just 5 past. So have a nice evening, we'll see you in the morning, whatever time you get up. And there is chanting here at 6 o'clock. Yeah, chanting at 6 o'clock. And a breakfast at 6:45, and another talk at 8 o'clock where we'll do a guided meditation. This is just introduction. Any questions before we finish off? Any complaints? Please remember, complaints always go to the caretakers or to the manager. Any praises come to the monks and the nuns. That's what we're here for. Isn't that the case, Venables? Yes. Okay, so have a good night. Those who want to carry on sitting here, fine. You want to go to your room to sit, have a cup of tea, go to bed, whatever.